really, really excited here on Book Corner to bring you our latest installment book on Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero, Douglas Perry. This book is available from Viking. It is excellent. Douglas, first things first, welcome and congratulations to you on this book.
Well, thank you, Tony. I really enjoyed writing it, and it's been nice to see the response that it has received.
Why Elliot Ness? Why did that interest you?
Well, my previous book, The Girls of Murder City, it took place in Chicago in the 1920s. So during my research, Al Capone came up, and so, of course, Elliot Ness came up. And just out of interest, curiosity, I started to look into Ness a little bit. And I was surprised to learn that there wasn't a whole lot out there. He's famous for the Untouchables, and justifiably so. He risked his life day after day chasing Capone's gang. But, you know, he was only 28 years old when the Untouchables squad was formed, and the team lasted less than a year. So this was just the beginning of Ness's career, and it turns out it was far from the highlight. Ness was one of the most influential lawmen of the 20th century, and it had nothing to do with the Untouchables. That came later, mainly in Cleveland, when he was the safety director in the 1930s and early 40s.
I think that's a really interesting facet of his life, because it's almost as if in the lore of the eyes of the public, Elliot Ness is almost like a one-hit wonder for what happened while he was in Chicago. And the bulk of the stuff, the research you did from his time in Cleveland, really was mind-boggling how ahead of his time this guy was.
That's true. I mean, researching this book was really a lot of fun for exactly the reason you say. Here you have this man who is an icon, a household name around the world, thanks to Hollywood. And yet we know very little about the actual person. And much of what we know is wrong. For 50 years, his memoir, it pretty much has stood as the official story of his life. But he didn't write The Untouchables, and it was published after his death, and a lot of it was fiction. He was very conflicted about it, and he died, you know, before it came out. And it turned out that his real life was actually a lot more interesting than the memoir. He was a lot more interesting, much more complicated, in some ways troubled person, but a stand-up guy. And you did particularly see this in Cleveland. He came down to Cleveland as the public safety director, which is kind of a combination of police chief and fire chief. And he was 33 years old, still the youngest man to be safety director in Cleveland. Cleveland at this time was the sixth largest city in the country. The population has contracted dramatically in the past few decades. It was incredibly corrupt. Now that Capone was in prison, it was arguably the most corrupt city in the country. Completely, the government was run by the mob, and that's why actually he got the job. Is the mayor, Mayor Burton, who was new in office, a reformer. He had his eye on a couple of other more experienced, better-known men, but it was well known how corrupt the city government was and how difficult it would be to really do this job well. And so he had a couple of people turn him down. So he finally turned to Ness, and Ness jumped at the opportunity, and he really saw this as an opportunity to do new things. It was the Depression, so there wasn't a lot of money, and so he got to really kind of revolutionize policing in this country, and he did, from new technologies, using ballistics, things like that, to crime prevention programs. That was completely new. He was severely criticized for his officers were, you know, derided as being social workers, and in many ways they were, and the things that they did, going out in the community, working with juvenile delinquents, as they called them then, working with homeless and drug addicts, not to throw them in prison, but to help them and to seek solutions. This is pro forma work now that police do across the country. But Ness was the first, certainly in a big city, to do this kind of work. And it had a huge impact, and he changed policing.
And he did it at a time where he was so young, which is really remarkable about his story. And what else is remarkable about his story, if you go back just a few years earlier from the time he was in Chicago, was, and we learned this from your book, was that he ends up with the Untouchables in the oddest of ways. It isn't as if he's some kind of standout guy. He's just sort of almost one of the last people standing, right? I mean, it wasn't as if they thought, oh, this is a really gifted young man, we've got to have him. He just sort of inherited a position there, right?
In a sense, that's true. Yeah, I mean, of course, a huge problem in the Prohibition Bureau was corruption. Al Capone, at his height, was spending $1 million a month, $1 million every month, bribing Prohibition Bureau agents, judges, Chicago police officers. And this is $1 million a month in the early 1930s and late 1920s. That's a huge amount of money. So it's very difficult to combat the Capone gang because there are very few honest agents in the Prohibition Bureau. And so that is why the Untouchable Squad was formed, because they needed this small insular group that they felt could be counted on to be honest. And Ness's brother-in-law, Alexander Jamie, was high up in the Chicago office in the Prohibition Bureau. He helped get Ness hired, a year out of college for Ness. And Jamie helped him get this job for the Untouchables. Ness was just thrilled to be considered for this special squad. And then in his interview with the prosecutor, George E.Q. Johnson, he impressed him. He impressed him with his passion and his dedication. And he did have a clean record. He hadn't made any big busts, but he was recognized as being honest and forthright and by the book. And so he got the job as being the leader of the team.
An anecdote I really love in your book that you talk about is when some of the girls in his office are all gathered and they're on a sort of a weekend getaway, and they're partying, right? I mean, they're all sort of together and they're enjoying themselves. And I guess they were by the lake or something like that. I do recall from your book. Here comes Elliot Ness through the door, and they're thinking, oh my gosh, this guy's going to bust us. But he's really there to see a lady. And one of the great ironies of Elliot Ness's story is that he liked to have a nip every now and again, didn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah, and of course, drinking became a big problem in his life later in his life. Ness did not become a prohibition agent because he thought liquor was a scourge. He was a drinker from college days on more than a few occasions. Not all of the bootleg liquor he confiscated on a raid made it back to the federal warehouse on Chicago's west side. He would load up the trunk of his car and drive it over to the house of an old fraternity buddy who would store the booze for him. He also knew how to get on the side of newspapermen. He recognized that it was important to get good press, not to puff himself up, but because that would help get the public on the side of the Prohibition Bureau. So he would call newspaper photographers into his office, and he would tell them to bring empty camera cases. And then they would fill up their camera cases with booze, and you know they would leave with those cases clinking and sloshing. And it's not that he was hypocritical. It's that he believed in law and order. And I think it was widely recognized that Prohibition wasn't working and it wasn't going to last. But what had happened during Prohibition is that it gave rise to these incredible gangster empires. So booze was just the catalyst that led to these huge illicit businesses that did everything from prostitution to gambling to murder, of course. And that led to the breakdown of society. And that's what Ness knew had to be stopped. And if that meant destroying bootlegging, even though he thought drinking shouldn't be illegal, then that's what he was going to do because he believed in order. And that trumped everything else, ultimately.
Douglas Perry is joining us. Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero. And by the way, Douglas has a website you ought to check out, douglasperry.net. And one other thing, if you're a fan of true crime, you enjoy this sort of genre, this book's a must-have for you. I'm telling you, you will not be able to put it down. When you look at the life of Elliot Ness, and another thought for you here, as I read your work, I couldn't help but think, wow, what a gifted guy. What a prolific career that shot into space. It was there. Then it was gone. But in the midst of all that, against this backdrop, and you talked about it before, what a complex guy he was. And his personal life was kind of a train wreck, wasn't it?
It was. He had a depressive personality, and I'm sure that's what led him to being a drinker himself. He came from an emotionally stifling family background. Norwegian, didn't express their emotions. His father was a workaholic. He owned a successful bakery on the south side of Chicago and was very dedicated, working just 7 days a week. Didn't pay much attention to Elliot. Elliot was by far the youngest child in the family, a late child, and his father kind of felt, he was 50 years old when Elliot was born, kind of felt, I've already raised kids, and this was an accident. And he just wanted to work at his bakery, and he didn't want to raise more kids. Not that he didn't love Elliot, just didn't give him much time. And I think this affected Elliot. He was an inward-looking kid who struggled with the blues all the time, never knew why. You know, people didn't understand depression back at that time. And so this, in part, I think made him really great at his job, because that focused his mind. He loved the camaraderie of the Untouchables and just being a part of these men with this mission, and kept his mind off of other things. He had three wives. They were all undercut by how hard he worked and by his drinking and frankly, by his womanizing, which he did. It's hard to say for sure why, but I think part of it was just that was another thing, like the booze, that kind of lifted him up. And, you know, when I started doing research for this book, I knew I'd be uncovering a whole different man than the one that existed in popular culture. And I was a little worried that the Elliot Ness I discovered wouldn't be likable. I already knew he drank too much. I knew he cheated on his wife. And it can be rough sledding to write a whole book about someone who's not likable. Fortunately, I really didn't have to worry, as it turned out. I mean, Ness was a flawed man. He made mistakes, as we all do. But he did things for the right reasons, even if they were the wrong things a lot of the time. And I found him to be a very admirable man on the whole. He tried to be a good man. That was important to him. He didn't always succeed, but he wanted to be good. Integrity was important to him. He was absolutely incorruptible in his professional life. His last years are kind of sad because he became an alcoholic and really struggled. I think it's nice that he is remembered as this great lawman, much more than the negative things of life, because those are things are all true, too. And he was a groundbreaking lawman, and he deserves to be remembered for the great things that he did.
I think your portrayal is spot on perfect from the standpoint, and I think you struck a great balance. Because at the end of the day, how many people do you know that are really gifted, and do I know that are really gifted? But yet we look at them and we project this deity type of presence on them, when the reality is they're people just like us. They have problems, they have struggles, they have strife, they have tension, and they have demons, things they struggle with. And at the end of the day, when you look under the hood at somebody like him, who's as brilliant as he is, but yet he has whatever it is he's going through, his mess, as you said earlier, it creates so much more of a dimension. The story as written, as it's real, is so much better than the glossed over version. There's a guy, like you said, who tried to do the right thing, but yet the whole time he's struggling inside. He's not good at his relationships. He picks one woman in particular, he picks as marrying material. You write in the book, she was so bad. When she died, the last guy she was married to, tell the story there about when she was buried, what they did with her body. Tell that story.
Right. Yeah, it's Eveline Ness, Elliot's second wife, who was a fascinating person, a very talented artist, and later, you know, in her life became a children's book illustrator and author, which is a little ironic in that she didn't like children. Beautiful woman. She was a model early in her life, but she certainly had her own demons and was a heavy drinker, struggled with her sexuality as well. They connected in many ways because they had this similar struggle. So they thought they understood each other and could help each other from that perspective. But in fact, they ended up just kind of fueling each other's demons. And it was a very volatile relationship. She could be absolutely charming, lovely person. But when she drank, she became very difficult, very confrontational. As her life went along, she became more and more of an alcoholic, so that it really ruined her life late in her life and her third husband's very tough relationship. And when she died in the 1980s, they didn't know what to do with the body. He just said, just throw it away. I'm not interested. I don't want the ashes. Just throw it in the trash. And that really kind of, you know, sums up what it was like, you know, the difficulty of dealing with such a personality when she's throes of alcoholism.
How do you find something like that when you're researching? How do you, that nugget there, how did you unearth that?
I talked to her stepchildren, and then from there to other people who knew her late in her life, her editor at her publishing house. One person leads to another, and you find friends who are still alive, and you just dig into it. You know, once someone's gone, people tend to be a little more willing to be open and honest about the dark side as well as the good stuff.
Great irony about Eliot Ness. Eliot Ness dies in, I'm from Pennsylvania, okay, so we would have called it upstate Pennsylvania, where he ended up. Eliot Ness dies in virtual anonymity, right? He never sees himself become the household name that we know him to be. At the end of his life, he was a guy searching for himself, right? Searching for his niche and struggling with the alcoholism, struggling with the depression that basically went on unabated in his life. It manifests itself in many forms, as you say, and basically died in his struggles, in his sorrows. Isn't that ironic? He never saw it, right?
Right. Yeah, he was nationally famous for a very brief period, right, when the Untouchables at their apex, when Capone was indicted. He had a big splash of national publicity. But the media wasn't all pervasive then like it is now, and so his name quickly fell out of the news. Went down and got the job in Cleveland. Most people had never heard of him. The mayor, you know, when his name was first brought up as someone to consider, the mayor hadn't heard of him. Fame wasn't the same kind of thing then that it is now. And so he became very well known in Cleveland, but he was not nationally known. And then after he left public safety job in Cleveland, he went in business, which he was not successful in. He became completely forgot, lived in a little town, Countersport, the end of his life. Most of the people he knew in the town knew nothing about his previous life. When he died and some of the news came out about he'd been in the Untouchables and all this, they were shocked because he was just this quiet, little unassuming man. They had no idea. And that was one of the struggles of when he was telling stories one day, drinking with Oscar Fraley, the newspaper man who ghost wrote The Untouchables, and Fraley said, "This is a great story. We should do a book." And Ness, his attitude was, "Who would be interested in that? Who would be interested in me?" So he did not see himself as a hero, and he would have been shocked at how successful the book was. He certainly would not have recognized himself in the portrayal by Robert Stack in the TV series or in the movie by Kevin Costner. He was not a laconic, tough guy. He was not a prim, golly-gee moralist. He's not what you would have thought of when you think of a lawman. He was quiet, very funny. He had a great sense of humor. He was bashful. But at the same time, you know, when he was doing his job, he was relentless. Gangsters really were scared of him. A lot of contradictions there. It's a fascinating figure.
And it's a great book. And you did a great job tying it together as Douglas Perry is joining us. And one of the things I love about doing what I do is I get to interface with folks like yourself. And people that are really great with the written word, like yourself, have a way of putting us there. And that's what you did in this book. I found myself thinking, wow, what an age this guy lived in. What a life this guy lived. What a sad way for him to go out in virtual anonymity, and he never got to see the level of appreciation that people have for him, his life. Here's a guy who virtually, I don't want to say he died penniless, but he wasn't exactly well off. He really needed the money right at the time when they were talking about writing the book.
I think it would be pretty accurate to say he was penniless. Now, he never owned a house. The car he was driving at the time of his death, the back window had been blown out somehow, something happened, and he couldn't afford to get it fixed, so he just had cardboard over it. He was broke. That's one of the things he was struggling with the time that he died, is he had just received the manuscript from Oscar Fraley, and he saw that it was highly fictionalized, and he was shocked and upset, and he called Fraley up and said, "This was a mistake. I don't want to do this book." And Fraley said, "Hey, you know, that's not the way it works, pal. We've got a contract." Anyway, Fraley had sent him half of the advance from the publisher, and Ness had spent it. Even if he wanted to say, "Here, take your money back," he couldn't. He didn't have the money anymore. And so he was trying to figure out, how can I edit this and be comfortable with this? And while he was working that over, he died of a heart attack at just 55.
You know something I couldn't figure out from your book, and maybe you help me out here. Why would somebody who was so successful in Chicago in law enforcement and such an absolute supernova in terms of his job in Cleveland as the safety director you were pointing out there, just did things that were so far advanced and way ahead of his time, Why would a guy like that walk away from law enforcement? Did you ever figure out what the reason was there?
Sure. Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. One, his tenure in Cleveland ended on a down note. He had a car accident after a late night of drinking with Eveline. I don't know how drunk he was. He'd certainly been drinking through the night, but that was pretty common then. People knocked back some drinks and then they drove home. No one really thought anything about that at the time. But he was embarrassed. He tried to keep it quiet. He didn't want it to be in the papers. He didn't deny it. He, you know, filled out a police report. But he tried to keep it quiet, and so the newspapers made a much bigger thing out of it, you know, than they really deserved. And he was extremely embarrassed. So he decided, oh, I've lost my moral authority, which was going overboard. But again, he's a depressive personality, so he would take things too far in the negative direction when things happened to him that were not good. So he said, I can't do this job anymore. So he went and got himself a job during the war effort. This was 1942, and it was kind of a crummy little job. He made a lot more of it in a positive way than it deserved. He was the social protection director. It was his job to bring down the VD rate among soldiers, which, believe it or not, was a huge problem during the war. But it wasn't a high-profile, glamorous job to have in Washington, D.C. during the war. He kind of became forgotten during the war years. He would have had to kind of really put himself out there after the war to get another police job. He was drifting into alcoholism. I don't think he had the energy left to really do that and to kind of start over with a whole new department. And on top of that, he needed to make money. He'd never made serious money as a lawman. And so he had contacts in Cleveland that led him to get a nice executive job. And so he took it. Nice salary, nice stocks. So he saw an opportunity to provide for his family. He just got married again. They'd adopted a son. And so he saw the need to make money. Money had never been important to him. And so he'd never really thought about salary. When he was hired as safety director, he didn't even ask about the salary. It turns out he was getting a big bump up in raise in pay from what he'd been making the federal government. Didn't even cross his mind to say, oh, what are you going to pay me? Unfortunately, he was just a terrible businessman. And so he got fired and bounced around and ended up doing some pretty menial jobs just to pay the rent.
We visited with Douglas Perry. He's the author of Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero. Some of this stuff that you unearthed is almost too good to be true from writing a book standpoint. Let's go back to his Cleveland years. In the midst of all this, there's a serial killer on the loose. And you kind of interwove that into the story because, as it turns out, he was related to somebody that was pretty high up the food chain there. And as great writers can do, you made it a part of the story while not making it too much of a large part, but it was there. It was sort of in the background. Were you surprised at how much stuff was out there as you did research into this guy?
It's amazing that this serial killer case is not well known. It's known in Cleveland, but in the rest of the country, most people have not heard of the Torso Killer, as he was known. Starting in the 30s, right before Ness got the job in Cleveland, torsos, limbless torsos, started showing up, drained of blood, around Cleveland. Needless to say, this caused a panic. People were terrified in Cleveland. There was no evidence, it was a complete mystery who this was. And it kind of went on for a while, not much happening with it, without it being a big story. But then, in 1936, the Republicans held their national convention in Cleveland. In the run-up to the convention, there were two new bodies showed up. And this made it an even bigger story. And now it started to get national press. And so the mayor called in Ness and said, this needs to be priority number one. You need to take care of this. So Ness became personally involved. He kind of kept it at arm's length for his first months in office because, one, they weren't sure it was a serial killer. It could have been some weird coincidences. And on top of that, you know, I think he recognized this was some kind of crazed individual doing this. And that was very difficult to catch someone like that because you couldn't apply logic to it. You couldn't work out strategy for capturing this guy, which is something he really enjoyed doing. That's one thing he loved about being a lawman. But with something like this, it was going to take a lot of luck. So he didn't really want to get involved with it. But he did. threw a huge amount of resources at it, and over time, he did figure out, in his mind, officially, believe it or not, this is still an open case in Cleveland, who, after being gassed in World War One, started to have mental problems, seriously went downhill, and kind of disappeared from society. The thing is, he was a cousin of a congressman from the Cleveland area, so that made it especially difficult to do anything about it. But Ness did get the man, Francis Sweeney, sent away to a mental institution, but he couldn't publicize it, and he couldn't get a conviction, didn't have the evidence for that, and he couldn't publicize it because it was a man related to a powerful politician. And when he ran for mayor a little bit later, this came up in the campaign, and Ness was put out that he couldn't say, I feel like I've gotten this guy. You know, it was very, very frustrating for him.
Yeah, and that shows you what an honorable guy he is, because today what happens is somebody leaks that, right? But he didn't even do that, which shows you the kind of guy that Elliot Ness was. And by the way, this book's available from Viking Press. It is Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero. Douglas Perry, I'd like you to have the final word here as we wrap this up on the life and times, the rise and fall of Elliot Ness. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much for this, Tony. I've really enjoyed this conversation we've had. Elliot Ness was a remarkable man, and I really enjoyed getting to know him through the research. It's very difficult these days to find such a well-known personality who hasn't been well picked over by journalists and historians. It was such a wonderful surprise to discover that so much of this man's life had just fallen away into the mists of time. So I was digging up a lot of information that had never come forward before, that had never been found. And it's just amazing stuff. He was a remarkable man, and bring his name back to where it deserves to be. He's taken some hits, his reputation, in recent years, because, strangely enough, his Hollywood fame has come to become a detriment to his reputation, because historians knew enough to know that it wasn't the real truth. Ken Burns did a documentary on Prohibition a few years ago, and in an interview promoting the documentary, he was asked about Ness, and he said, oh, Elliot Ness, he accomplished nothing of significance, and then years later he wrote a book in which he just made stuff up. I was waist deep in research when I read that, and I was just amazed. Ken Burns is very well respected as a historian, and here he was spouting off about something he knew absolutely nothing about. And I think that's very unfortunate that this kind of negative blowback to the Hollywood myth has happened, because while the Hollywood myth obviously isn't true, that doesn't mean that Elliot Ness was not a heroic, courageous man. He certainly was, and he deserves to be recognized.
So well put, and really, really well done. Congratulations to you again. I greatly and thoroughly enjoyed talking with you. Appreciate you spending your time with us as well as your talent. Great talking with you, Douglas Perry.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
All right, once again, that's Elliot Ness, The Rise and Fall of an American Hero. Douglas Perry, and this concludes today's edition of Book Corner.